pleased to welcome to the program a local author by the name of Donna Authors on her book, A Sacred Walk, Dispelling the Fear of Death and Caring for the Dying. And I got to tell you, I sat down with this book and I was riveted over the past couple days reading it. I really didn't want to put it down. It not only is such an important subject matter, but it is extremely well written. To the point that it's a page-turner. It's what you would call a page-turner. And books on death and dying are not often the case. So, Donna, thank you for joining us here on The Shilling Show. We've got so much to talk about in this hour. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for the invitation to be here, Rob.
And many of our people are listening to the show on at work, and they have a computer next to them. So you can go over to the website for the book to get more information on Donna and this book at asacredwalk.com. That's asacredwalk.com. So would you tell us a little bit about your own background, maybe what you do for a living or what you did for a living during your professional life?
Oh, all right. Be happy to. Well, most of my professional life, I worked in business and sales and marketing, actually for the IBM Corporation. And it was an exciting life, and I just focused primarily on that. But after meeting my husband in Paris on a business trip.
How romantic, yeah.
Yes, it was lovely. I took early retirement and then began volunteering at our church to help people who were going through various crises in life, many of whom were dealing with life-threatening illnesses. In my own family, I experienced many tragic deaths at a very early age, and it was working in this capacity that I had some value from the tragedy that our experience that our family experienced over the years.
I want to give people a sense of this, and I don't want us to spend too much time on it, but you talk about this, and a lot of people think they've had tragedy in their life, but would you give us just a brief rundown of those that you covered in the book? Because I want people to have a sense of the background and what you lived through as a young person.
Well, it started when I was about 2 years old. My father was killed in World War II and left my mother to raise me all by herself. And that really changed our life forever, and I have such empathy for our military personnel, and every time I hear of somebody passing away or somebody coming home with life-changing physical limitations, my heart just breaks for them. My sister died on my fifth birthday. Obviously, my mother remarried, and I woke to the screams of such a tragic infant death. She died of spinal meningitis at the age of 7 months. Mm. And
this occurred on your birthday, which must have
on my birthday, my
changed
birthday.
Your birthday, the dynamic of having a birthday and celebrating that day for the rest of your life, I'd
that
imagine.
That and also my fear of doctors.
Yes.
Because it was very frightening to be held down at 5 years of age, being examined by a doctor when you were expecting to wake up to a celebration.
Yes.
So it was pretty traumatic at that time. As I grew older, we thought maybe life would be a little smoother, but my grandfather, when I was about, I think I was 15 years old, committed suicide.
Mm.
So we've experienced suicide in our family, and that was very, very tragic. My uncle, who was like a brother to me, we were about 4 years apart, and he was killed tragically in an automobile accident when I was 20 and he was 24. And that was a very, very sad time for me and our family. I remember my grandmother lost 50 pounds in 1 month with the grief and the sorrow of losing her youngest son. And not long after that, she lost her youngest daughter. My Aunt Bessie died at the age of 38 with an unknown illness.
And this was traumatic as well, as you described it in the book, because she was yelling out or crying out that she was dying and asking for help, and how traumatic that must have been for everybody around.
Yes, it was. And she knew she was dying. She just felt that way. And she was screamed, "Mama, save me. I'm dying." And it was very, very sad. And
so this was your childhood and your young adulthood. Mm-hmm. You were steeped in this, and there are many people who are isolated from death at mm-hmm. young ages because mm-hmm. they just don't have anybody die in their family, mm-hmm. or maybe their parents keep them away from it. That wasn't a choice for you, and you lived that. So as you were a young person mm-hmm. and having had all these experiences, what were your thoughts on death and dying at the time?
I was terrified of death. I absolutely, you know, there was a childhood little ditty that the kids sang, and they thought it was funny at the time, but it used to just drive me crazy. And it was like, the worms crawl in, the worms crawl out, your teeth decay and your eyes fall out. Mm. And so with my background and this childhood, you know, rhyme, I was terrified. I hugged the walls of funeral homes. If I had to go pay my respects to any relative or close family friend, I just dreaded it. I made my mother promise me that if I ever died before her, that she would put me in a mausoleum. I didn't want to be in the ground.
It's an interesting perspective, and I remember being a young person and not really having good equipment to deal with death and dying and and often focusing on that on the decay part of it without really having a true hope in me for what the future would hold. It's a hard thing for kids to process. It's hard for adults, but can you imagine kids or young people having to deal with
this? Yes, and I experienced a lot of anger, too, because if I ever had to go to a funeral home, you know, people were talking and laughing, and here I was grieving so deeply over a family member, perhaps, and I couldn't understand how people were dealing with death. Nobody ever taught me how to deal with death.
Even though I think, you know, and I can say I come from an Italian family like you did, and I've been in some of these big family wakes after after somebody had passed away, and I think a lot of it, you know, at least in my own family, was just not comfortable laughter, but kind of uncomfortable, and they were kind of talking about run-of-the-mill things because they didn't know what else to say, and they didn't know how to process it, and sometimes that faith background wasn't there. So I think sometimes people handle it in that way, too, kind of laughing, but it feels insulting if it's somebody that you love. If someone's there telling a story about something that happened at work yesterday, it almost feels like an insult sometimes if you don't know how to process that.
Especially if you are a young person and never really been taught on how to deal with it and how and the various ways people do deal with death and dying.
Absolutely, it is. You know, a lot of people, and we're talking with Donna Authors, the book is A Sacred Walk, Dispelling the Fear of Death and Caring for the Dying. And we're going to be giving away a couple copies of the book later on in the show today, so I want you to stay tuned and be ready for that. Not yet, but in just a few minutes. Mm-hmm. A lot of people look at this and say, well, I've got to find a scapegoat. And in one of the chapters of the book, you talk about the great scapegoat. And who are you referring to in that chapter?
Well, the great scapegoat in many cases is God.
Yes.
We even call natural disasters acts of God.
It's interesting how we do that, but that's a societal scapegoating, isn't it?
That is. It is. And we tend to not want to take responsibility for our actions, and we look for a scapegoat. If not God, it's our mothers or fathers, or it's society. You know, we just don't normally want to take responsibility for our own actions.
One of the things that you talked about in your book was your reaction upon hearing that your mother was ill, and you got angry with God. And I thought this was a beautiful scene because a lot of people think that they should never be angry with God, but you had a talk with somebody who told you differently. Could you describe what happened and then what happened after that when you talked to your friend and had a different perspective?
Oh, yes, indeed. When my mother called and said the words, Donna, I have cancer.
Hard to hear.
It was very hard to hear, and I tried to keep it together. I was internally screaming myself, but trying to keep her calm. But when we hung up, I just started ranting and raving at God, shaking my fist to heaven and saying, you either heal her or you take her. Do not let her suffer. Who do you think you are that you should, you know, let her suffer? You were supposed to have suffered for all of us. I just didn't know what to do with myself. I didn't know if he was listening to me. I started yelling, you know, please give me a sign if you can hear me. And I started yelling for grandma and my daddy, anybody who was up there with him in my mind to help me. And all of a sudden, Sister Therese came to mind. Sister Therese is one of the women to whom I've dedicated the book. She was a spiritual mentor to me, and I called her. She happened to be running a hermitage in Arizona, and she answered the phone immediately, which was highly unlikely, but I think that was a God thing.
Yes.
And when I told her what I had been doing, yelling and screaming, she started to laugh at me. And I asked her why she was laughing when I was crying. And she said, I'm not laughing at you, child. I'm laughing with you. I am delighting in the fact that you have such a wonderful relationship with God. you know, you're married to Roger, and if you have a fight and you're angry, that doesn't have anything to do with whether or not he loves you. So God knows. He's the one who gave you your emotions. So it's okay to be angry with God. He can handle it. His shoulders are big enough.
What a beautiful lesson. And I think many of us, depending on our faith background and how we're brought up, are often taught just the opposite, that, you know, it's disrespectful to God. And you know, there certainly are lines there. But God has sent his son because he wants to befriend us as well and to have that relationship with us. Mm-hmm. So in reading this, it was just a beautiful picture of somebody taking this issue and saying, how great it is that you could actually do this, that you yourself probably never would have thought of it that way.
Well, I didn't for many, many years. My concept of God was quite different than having a personal relationship with God. I always thought that I knew God created us and gave us talents and abilities, and we were responsible for identifying them and doing the best we could. And on Judgment Day, we'd find out how well we did. Mm. You know, so he was a God that was kind of up there, out of reach. And I never realized until actually it was around the time of my grandmother's death that it was much more personal than that.
And it is fascinating how God uses life and death issues to bring us closer to him. Mm-hmm. But it's a matter of being open to taking advantage of that, because, as you said, there's a scapegoat aspect where people are angry with God and instead will use it as an excuse sometimes for years. You and I may have had this experience younger, for pushing God away from us instead of embracing him and saying, you know, this is a gift in showing you how I can be closer to you.
Well, I have an example of that in my own family, and that was my mother. She became angry with God in 1945 when her husband was killed and held on to that anger until 1979. Many, many years of pent-up anger toward God, and she blamed him for everything bad that happened in her life, and she thought that she was cursed.
It's amazing the things that we learn about in the course of life and the things that God teaches us. All right, to caller number 8 right now at 977-1070, 977-1070, a copy of the book, A Sacred Walk, Dispelling the Fear of Death and Caring for the Dying. This is a remarkable book, and I suggest that you call in to get your free copy. We'll have another one later. And if you have questions or comments for Donna Authors on death and dying, she is an expert, and when you read this book, you'll know what I'm talking about. We'll take your calls after the news. Stand by. Some practical issues for people to consider preparing to die. Now, a lot of people don't like to think about this, but you had listed some things that I want the audience to hear in your book about what are the practical things that people need to do, hopefully well in advance of being in the middle of the process, because that's the most difficult time to deal with what should I be doing, is when you've been diagnosed with a terminal illness, isn't it?
Absolutely. But the first thing, Rob, is to accept the reality of our mortality.
That's hard for people to do.
Very hard for people to do. And our society today doesn't want us to dwell on death. They want us to dwell on living and getting more and accumulating more. And that's well and good. But the fact of the matter is, whether you are a Republican or Democrat, or whether you live in the United States or in Europe, the mortality rate is the same for everyone.
It's true, isn't it?
It is 100%.
Yeah.
You know, we can joke about it, but the fact of the matter is, none of us is getting out of this alive.
That's true.
Even Lazarus, whom Jesus raised from the dead, died
the second time.
Yes, absolutely.
He did.
The only person who was raised from the dead and still lives is Jesus.
That's right. That's right. It's remarkable to look at it like that. So let's talk about some of the practical things that you've advised people that they need to do while they're able to do it easily. You talked, for example, about a living will.
Absolutely. I mean, everybody knows the importance of making a will. And certainly, especially with the Terry Schiavo case, you know, many years ago, we know how important having a living will is. But you would be amazed at how many people do not take the time to do it, especially when they're young. And they think, well, I've got plenty of time left. Well, we know in this age of terrorism, in sicknesses and accidents and wars, you don't know how long you're going to live.
And it's always been like that. But I think that the things like September 11th, which you reference in your book, showed us that, you know, you might be here 1 minute and gone the next. You never know. There are no guarantees beyond the breath that you're taking right now. You also talked about a DNR, a do not resuscitate. And some people may not be familiar with that.
A do not resuscitate order is something that you have to have in place to actually supplement a living will. If you're in a hospital and you have a living will, even if it's attached to your chart, and there's a crisis, a health crisis there, the hospitals are designed to save you, to cure you, and they won't pay attention to a living will. If you do not want to be resuscitated, all right, you have to have a separate form completed that your doctor has to sign in conjunction with you in order for that to be obeyed.
And this was in the book, not specifically to this, but about the charts being overlooked one time with your mother and how you really had to take the doctor to task. So people need, this takes us to the next one, which is a healthcare agent.
Right.
And I had never heard the term before, but what does a healthcare agent do for you?
A healthcare agent or a surrogate or, you know, somebody who has like a durable power of attorney is a person who can be your advocate. Someone who can speak for you if you are unable or unwilling. You might be under too much emotional stress and you want someone to talk to the doctors and the medical staff. And this is the person who will have legal authority to make sure your wishes are carried out.
And that is very, very important when you're in a vulnerable position to get that lined up in advance of your vulnerability, because it's a tough thing to do when you're dealing with the illness, as you have personally. I mean, you have been through a difficult cancer yourself, have you not?
Actually, I have. About a year and a half ago, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I had to draw on the many lessons that I learned from the people that I cared for over the years. So I can speak from experience that the lessons that I have tried to outline in this book, ones that they have given me, are true and are valid. And I really needed to write this book because I promised them that I would share the lessons and their wisdom and their advice with other people. That was one of their last wishes of me. And my way of thinking, it was a final gift. And more than a gift, it was a legacy that I needed to share with people. And I don't have any children, Rob. And this was my way of perhaps having their life extended if I were able to capture their thoughts on the pages of this book.
It's beautifully done. And this is a manual that I would suggest for people. And it's not like a textbook. It's written from the heart through vignettes and stories that are very touching and powerful. But the lessons within, I've never seen them gathered together like this before. I think that's what's important about the book. If you want to get a copy of it, it's available here locally at New Dominion. It's also available online at your favorite online bookseller. And of course, you can visit asacredwalk.com to get more information on Donna and the book. But I really highly recommend it if you're going through this, or even if you're not, to be prepared, because it's not an easy thing. And reading through your book, it brought back a lot of the experiences in my own life in dealing with this without having these tools, which was not very pleasant. I want to talk for a moment about the fears of dying and hospice. Hospice is for the living. And you went through this, and I thought this was remarkable, the fear that people who are dying have. And we don't think about it very often because most of us have never been there before, haven't been that close to worry about it. So let's talk about number one, the process. What is the fear of the process?
Oh, the fear of the process of dying? Well, most people are afraid of the process because they think it's going to be very painful. They wonder how in the world are they going to get through it. There are so many unknowns. And that's one of the fears of dying. But I have to say a word about hospice, if you don't mind.
Indeed, please.
I titled the chapter Hospices for the Living. And for some people, that may sound very strange, because most people think that hospice is a place that you call when you're on taking your last breath, the last week of your life, and only you call them when you need some pain management. That's not true. Hospice is for the living. You aren't dead yet.
That's right.
You know, and even if you're struggling with a life-threatening illness, you're still living, and you still have a lot to contribute. And hospice is designed to help people maintain the quality of the life that they have until they take their last breath. And it's also designed to care for not only the patient, but for the caregivers in a family, for the family members. It's a wonderful, wonderful organization, and they have so many resources available. In fact, they have a program called Transitions, where people can be supported through hospice, even when they're still in treatment, even when there's hope for a cure and the doctors haven't given up on them.
It is a wonderful program, and I speak from experience going through the death from lung cancer of my father-in-law almost 10 years ago now. Hospice came into what was a very chaotic situation and brought peace to the household, and it was very, very beautiful to see that. We're going to take a break because I want to have the long segment at the end here for us to continue with Donna Authors. The book is A Sacred Walk, Dispelling the Fear of Death and Caring for the Dying. And caller number 9 right now at 977-1070, we have an autographed copy of this book from Donna Authors. Caller number 9 at 977-1070. asacredwalk.com is the website, and we'll be back with The Shilling Show right after this. All right, News Radio 1070 WINA. Donna Authors is our guest. We're heading into the final segment of The Shilling Show. Such an important topic and something that people don't like to talk about, but this is a wonderful book. It's called A Sacred Walk, Dispelling the Fear of Death and Caring for the Dying. And we were talking about the seven fears of dying in the context of the hospice organization. And by the way, 977-1070 is the phone number if you have a question or comment. If you're going through this and want to speak with Donna about it, we'd be happy to hear from you at 977-1070. So loss of control, another one of the seven fears of dying. Why do people fear this, and how does it manifest itself?
Well, they fear the loss of control because nobody wants to give up their independence. They wonder whether they can cope with being dependent on others. And it's one of the most important things you can do to help somebody alleviate that fear is to allow them to maintain as much control as they can. And that sometimes can be very difficult because you want to do things for them.
That's
and
right.
In fact, they want to live a normal life as long as they are able to.
Let's go to the loss of loved ones, because that's certainly a huge one that weighs heavy on people's hearts.
Oh, it certainly did, and it certainly did on my mother. I mean, she, you know, was so worried about not only herself, but what was going to happen to us when she died. And I actually detailed a little very touching scene with my mom. We were kind of snuggling together in bed one morning.
It was a wonderful scene.
Thank you. And she very rarely cried, and she never wanted to see me cry, because if I did, she would cry. And she said, I'd be afraid I can't stop. I wouldn't be able to stop if I saw you crying. But one morning she said, do you know what really scares me, what I'm afraid of, and what worries me? I said, no, Mom, what? And she said, who's going to be with you when you die?
That's what she was thinking
about. She was thinking about that, because she was always there for me. Mm. And it was such a very touching scene, and it was amazing. I don't know how I found the words. I just said, why, you will, of course, Mom. Mm-hmm.
That's right. What a beautiful scene it was to read about in the book.
You'll be the angel on my shoulder.
And it was comforting to her and to you to think of
it in that way.
Yes. Fear of reactions is another big one.
Mm-hmm.
How do we deal with that, and what sort of reactions are we talking about?
Well, it depends on the type of illness somebody has. In cancer, for example, people have a change in their physical appearance. They lose their hair, perhaps. They might become bloated with medication. Their bodies could fill with fluid. And they really don't want to be seen by other people, and they're afraid of what people might think of them. So the fear of how people are going to react might lead them really to the next fear that I talk about in the book, and that's the fear of isolation. And they don't really want to see that fear reflected in people's eyes.
And so the isolation is that I'll just be by myself because I don't want people to see me. And there's nothing else I can do about that. I can't really change how I look, and I'm kind of embarrassed and feel uncomfortable with it. So this fear of being alone or not having your friends around you.
Exactly. And when a doctor tells a patient that there really isn't any more than that they can do for you, then they send you home. And, you know, you don't even have the companionship or the social interaction of doctors and nurses and aides that you would if you were in a rehab facility or a hospital, and you know.
These are people you build relationships with, and for any of us who have been there, when you spend some months or in some cases years with people, with caregivers, you do have a personal relationship with them, and then that's taken away once you're out of the setting. Mm-hmm. And then the last one, which was pretty interesting also, was the fear of a meaningless life. How do we confront that?
Well, you know, one of the things that I recommend people do is to review the life history of that person, to reflect on all the memories that they had, to tell them how much value their life has had to you. And that is so important, to just reaffirm that they had value and worth while they were here.
Indeed it is, and people do need to hear that. And it's sometimes mm-hmm. hard to say if you're raised, especially man, in a place where you don't tell somebody you love them or what they meant to you. I think that is very, very important.
And of course, the last one is the fear of the unknown. And what most people mean by that is there really a life after death? I mean, even a professed atheist and certainly an agnostic really wants to have hope. Everybody wants to have hope. Is this really all there is? So I recommend to people that you share your faith. And even if you have no faith, and you're caring for someone who wants to know the answer to that question, perhaps you could introduce them to somebody who does have faith.
It is a wonderful comfort to people, and I know there have been times I've been in the hospital and have shared my faith with people who I wasn't sure were there or not, and I think mm-hmm. it was a great comfort if I just asked them, can I pray with you? Mm-hmm. You know, and they were very delighted mm-hmm. to receive that mm-hmm. that question. Mm-hmm. Now, we don't have a lot of time left, but there is such an important thing here. Walking loved ones home, this is one of the hardest things that people have to deal with, is how do you handle it when somebody is terminally ill? And you have several steps here, and I hope we can get to all of them in the remaining minutes. Number one advice, and this is coming from the person who is ill now, don't ask me how to help. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that.
Well, what I've done in this section, Rob, is try to come up with the best tips, the most commonly discussed issues and concerns that my care receivers had over the years. And one of them was, don't ask me how to help, because they're in the middle of a crisis. And when they're confronted with having to tell you what you can do to help them, they can't even think straight.
So you need to, and it's outlined in the book, mm-hmm. we're not going to have time to get into the specifics, but you have outlined it here, some of the mm-hmm. specific things you can say and do to offer to help people instead of asking them, because everyone has a good heart who's asking, but you're right, it's another burden on the person for me to think of how I can put you to work to help me, as opposed to you mm-hmm. just coming up and saying, hey, I'm going to bring you some meals next week. This
exactly.
is what I'm going to do for you.
Well, I'll give you one example.
Yes.
My friend Dave was dying of lung cancer, and his wife Linda worked full time. And so a number of us got together and we did a schedule, made up a schedule, and we took turns driving him to and from his radiation treatments.
Dave's drivers.
That we pinned a little sign on the refrigerator, and you know, he looked forward to having quality time with his friends to and from the hospital, and maybe having a, you know, a little lunch afterwards.
It was a great example. The next one, don't make me talk about my condition. And this is an interesting one because some people think that they're just engaging you and letting you let it out. But people don't always want to talk about that, do they?
No. This is one that I really experienced this last year. No, this is very true. How are you is a very common greeting in America. But when somebody has an illness and you know that they're dealing with something life-threatening, how are you takes on a whole new meaning. They come over to you and say, how are you? Mm-hmm. How are you really? As if to ask, you know, tell me about your medical
what's
condition.
What's going on with you? That's right.
And, you know, when you are talking about your condition to doctors and family members, you know, constantly, you don't want to be confronted by everybody you meet walking down the street to talk about your medical condition. So what I started to do was say, how do I look?
That was my response.
How do I look?
Yeah.
Well, you look great. Well, there you go. How you look. It's who you know that counts, how you feel.
Another one, listen to me. And this is a big one.
Yes, yes. Let me read from the book.
Yes.
This is a summary of what I've heard my friends tell me. All my life I've been saying, listen to me, first as a child to my parents and then as a parent to my children. And if I said it once to my spouse, I've said it 1,000 times, you aren't listening to me. Now more than any other time in my life, I truly need someone to be fully present and hear me. Everybody wants to know what they can do, and all I really need is someone to listen to me.
And
I could go on,
but
the best thing you can do for someone is to listen, to love, and to pray.
Yes, indeed. It's such a wise advice for people. Help alleviate my fears.
Well, I think, you know, the chapter on under Hospices for the Living does cover the fears of many types of fears that a person has. And I think spending quality time with someone and asking them questions to see what kind of fears you're sensing in them, you can help alleviate their fears by addressing those issues and giving them some peace.
Help me maintain my dignity. And this is, and I think of all the people I've seen in the hospital who really have lost their dignity. They're they're under a hospital gown. They're going to the bathroom in front of people, and it's just, it's really hard.
Yes.
So how
do
we do this?
Well, one of the ways is you just pretend like you don't see anything except the person.
Yes.
You don't look around. Don't pay any attention to what you see or what you smell or what you hear. And be present and let them talk. Let them speak for themselves. So many times if I visited people who had other family members around and I would address them directly, it was like they were a ventriloquist. Somebody else would be answering for them. Now, they could still speak for themselves.
Yes,
so
that's
one of the
that's
things
important.
We need to do is let them speak for themselves and accept gestures of gratitude. They may want to give you little mementos so you can remember them. My mother was giving away little things out of her china closet every time somebody came to visit. If they admired something, she'd say, would you like to have it? And she'd give it away so they would remember them. And the most of all, you know, you can learn from them. They may be bedridden even, but if you listen to them and ask their advice and ask them to tell you stories of their life, there is so much we can learn from them.
There is. Donna Authors, we are out of time. Unfortunately, there's so much more to say. And I just want to let people know that you are available to talk about any or all of this book. And if people would like to have you as a speaker at their church or for their group to come by because it is such valuable information, they can do so. They can get a hold of Donna Authors at asacredwalk.com. This interview will be podcast at wina.com as soon as the show is over today. And in addition, we have one more copy of the book to give away right now to caller number 7 at 977-1070. That's caller 7 at 977-1070, a copy of this excellent book. It's really a manual for dealing with death and dying in a beautiful, beautiful way that you will want to read this. It's A Sacred Walk, Dispelling the Fear of Death and Caring for the Dying. Donna Authors, thank you so much for joining us here today.
And thank you, Rob.
It's been a great hour.